Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how is climate change affecting the ocean and marine life? What are the interactions between the Earth, the atmosphere, and the ocean? And how does that affect us? But first, a look at changes in environmental policies on local, state, national, and international levels. With us is Astrid Karapetaso. Astrid Karapetaso is assistant professor at the Political Science Department at the University of Freiburg. She's the author of The Greening of Free Trade and co-editor of Climate Resilient Development. Welcome to the Scholars Circle, Astrid Karapetaso. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks, Maria. It's great to be here.
So you've been studying environmental policy, sustainability, climate change, NGOs. That I thought we should talk about some of the things that you found. One of the things that I've noted from your work is this idea of diffusion, because so many of the policies, environmental policies, look the same. How does this happen?
Yeah, that's true. That's why I got interested in the topic as well, because worldwide you see a convergence of policies, and so they become similar. And the question is, yeah, that's a good question. How does it work? You got a lot of networks, global networks being around, exchange between governments, so bilateral relationships, but also like sort of interregional, like the EU dealing with other countries, either on a bi-regional level or also with regard to, for example, EU-ASEAN. How does it happen? It's difficult to say. It's a tricky research agenda because you can find correlations between the policies and you can try to work your way through and find out who talked to who about the policies. And actually what I wrote about China was that China was really interested in getting some ideas how they could deal with their environmental problems. So there was a regular exchange and they looked for other countries regarding best practice. So, but I think actually with the United States, I'm not an expert on this, but it's quite interesting to see that on the sub-state level. You've got a lot of best practice and really good ideas. So California would be a very good example for that. And also that this triggers further cooperation among the states, so which is quite good. So the question is, do changed federal policies have a real impact on the state level or not? So this is a thing you have to see. But also like upstate New York was pretty tough on fracking issues. So you could hope for other initiatives. So
Yeah, right. So I wonder also, you're talking about, for example, EU climate strategies being one of them that are inspiring others. Are these superior policies on climate? Are there something that, you know, other countries should be following?
I think you have to contextualize it, and this is what a lot of countries do. So they look for new ideas and see whether you have front runners. And the EU always wants to be the front runner because it has got quite a strong mandate in terms of climate action. As a European, you could also say, okay, we could still do better. But it's a start, and it's quite ambitious. And I think like Asian countries, for example, they look at these policies and figure out how it would work for their countries. Like, I mean, emission trading scheme is also quite a good example that some countries adopted, including New Zealand. The question is always, and we come back to the diffusion thing and convergence, is do they also learn from the mistakes made by others? Because obviously the emission trading system did not work too well in the European Union in the first run. So they made adjustments. And so when other countries look at these policies, for example, and think about their own countries, they have to figure out whether they could do it another way. So, and I think that's really important.
I know that one of the things that you have been looking at is the environmental NGOs and community groups and other non-governmental entities. What is the role that you think they're playing in all of this?
I think they are quite important players because for several reasons. So on the one hand, they often have a very good expertise in various issues because they focus on these issues. So they don't have a whole bunch of things they have to look at, even though if you look at environmental NGOs and what they do, it's quite a lot. So they can gather information and also make governments accountable for their action. So they are really important watchdogs to see whether the government does it the right way or not. And also that the means they have, like legal action, informing the public, and also that they, to a certain extent, represent the public. So some of their concerns, some of their interests. I mean, you can challenge that, but in general, I think it's not a false thing to consult with them. It's just a matter of who do you consult with, and I think that's the trickiest part of it.
You gave a talk here. You talked a little bit about the deep history, and I was quite surprised at how far back some of these environmental movements, when they began. Can you give us a little bit of that history?
It started quite early in the 19th century, and even longer back in history, they realized that, for example, cutting down trees in an unsustainable way is not the way it should go, because otherwise you don't have any resources anymore. And in the 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution, that was quite an issue, because you had air pollution, and that was pretty hard, and people suffered from it. And so you had this on the one side, and also you had the conservation side, so that they realized, actually we are losing some of our valuable resources and also like species. So they tried to protect that. And so therefore the environmental movement has quite a long history.
You used a couple of phrases during that talk that I thought were quite interesting. One was intellectual competition. What did you mean by that?
Well, intellectual competition in terms of what I've just said, in terms of having their expertise. So mostly it's sound research that they do and scientifically based. And so they come up with alternatives. So, I mean, as you know, research and science is a contested field. So you need different solutions to different problems. And if you have sort of a biased focus, sometimes it's good to have a different perspective on it. So this is probably what I meant by intellectual competition.
Do you think that it's partly these NGOs that have made the diffusion process happen, why there are some similar policies as well?
Actually, no.
You don't?
Well, some of them, so like conservation activities, I think that's really good in terms of cross-country and transboundary cooperation. But I think the major policies in terms of, let's say, air quality, transport, climate change, etc., are finally made by governments. So it's actually the exchange governments have, but NGOs can really help to promote the alternatives that they have. And what they can do is they can exchange best practice also on the local level. And I think that's quite crucial, because in the end, someone has to implement all the ideas and all the policies. And where is it done? On the local level. So it's good when you have the NGOs networking, and also on a global scale to exchange information about government policies, so to have a strong political leverage on the international level as well.
Do you think that they played a role in the trade agreement starting to get a little bit greener? I know this is a topic you researched a long time ago, but was that one of the factors in driving environmental sustainability into some of these trade agreements?
I think there were various factors involved, but certainly one was that they had a good exchange with government officials on this. So it played one role. It's not the most exclusive one, I would say, so that it was that single reason why they pushed for environmental agreements, in addition to New Zealand's green and clean image, which is suffering a bit at the moment, given the OECD report that's recently been released. But I think there was a wider awareness of environmental issues. I mean, all the side agreements I worked on in the past, they are binding agreements, but you don't have sort of a dispute settlement mechanism dealing with these issues. So that might actually change, because I had a look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I worked on that long time ago, and it wasn't that important. Now it got really important, and actually the clauses they have on the environment, they are again binding, and you can also challenge it. So there are some changes, I think. And it certainly has to do with the fact that also the World Trade Organization has a long trade and environment history. So they moved it a little bit in terms of framing towards more climate change. But the agenda is basically the same. And there have been arguments about trade disputes and the environment. And so this goes hand in hand a little bit. And also the country itself maybe has a better understanding of what it means for the environment if you increase free trade.
Finally, I wanted to get a sense from you if you think that these policies, both the international ones related to trade and these others that are being diffused out and copied from one another, are we doing enough?
That's a good question. I think you can always do more. When you see how the world looks like, and also, I mean, the climate negotiations have been there for a very long time, and it's a lengthy process and it's pretty slow. I'm quite pleased to see that quite a lot of action actually happens on sub-global levels. And also, for example, the cities have realized that they should have a stronger position in international negotiations and relations, and they have their partnerships and exchange knowledge and best practice. And I think there's still more room to do more. So we'll see how it will work out. Hopefully, policies get more ambitious.
Well, Astrid Karapetasio, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for inviting me.
Astrid Karapetasio is assistant professor at the Political Science Department at the University of Freiburg. She's the author of The Greening of Free Trade and co-editor of Climate Resilient Development. When we come back, how is the melting of sea ice affecting sea animals? How are some changing to adapt to climate change? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How is climate change affecting the ocean and marine life? What are the interactions between the Earth, the atmosphere, and the ocean? And how does that affect us? Finally, what measures can we take to prevent massive damage? We speak with three experts. Karina Nielsen is with us. She is a professor of biology and the executive director of the Estuary and Ocean Science Center at San Francisco State University. She's the co-author of California's fourth climate assessment, Coast and Ocean Summary Report, and Emerging Understanding of Seagrass and Kelp as an Ocean Acidification Management Tool in California. Stephen Palumbi joins us. He is a professor in marine sciences at Stanford University and the director of the Hopkins Marine Station. He is the co-author of publications including Using Naturally Occurring Climate Resilient Corals to Construct Bleaching Resistant Nurseries and Impacts of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services. Scott Donney is with us. He is a professor in environmental change in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia. He's the co-author of numerous publications, including Strengthened Scientific Support for Endangerment Finding for Atmospheric Greenhouse Gases and Anthropogenic Ocean Acidification Over the 21st Century and Its Impact on Calcifying Organisms. So welcome to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us. You know, we've finally got the media and much of the world focused on climate change, what it means for life on Earth, potential ways to mitigate. But there has been less attention on the intersection with the oceans. So when we talk about the oceans, we also see a lot on plastics pollution, which is obviously a huge problem. And perhaps we'll talk about that a little bit more now. But I thought we should start also with the oceans and climate change. As I understand, the oceans have actually served as a bit of a bulwark in that they've been absorbing a lot of the carbon dioxide so that it has lessened some of the impacts terrestrially, but now we're facing some changes. Is that true? And could you help us understand what those dynamics are.
I can start off. So this is Scott Doney. We think the oceans have absorbed about a quarter to a third of all the human emissions of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. That's a positive, but on the negative side, that actually is changing seawater chemistry, leading to ocean acidification. The other thing the oceans are doing is actually slowing the warming of the planet. A lot of the excess heat building up in the planet is actually building up in the oceans. So if it wasn't for the oceans, there'd be a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the atmosphere would be warmer.
So if it's absorbing a chunk of the carbon dioxide, the oceans, is there a limit where it just can't absorb anymore?
We think it's going to slow down. It doesn't stop, but it will probably slow down. And one of the concerns is the ocean is what's going to happen to, as the climate warms up, to some of the land carbon sources. So potentially if the climate warms up enough, you'll get venting of a lot of carbon out of the Arctic, and then that's going to make it even harder for the ocean to buffer our climate and carbon system.
And what happens then?
Well, then atmospheric carbon dioxide goes up. That drives more climate change and an accelerating pace of change that society needs to deal with.
And what's the likelihood of that right now?
I'd say that it's probably likely that the land also is helping to buffer some of this carbon dioxide. We think that the land's going to slow down. Whether it's going to reverse and become a source, we don't know.
Karina Nielsen, let's bring you in. What would you add to that?
We are concerned about the potential slowdown of the ocean's capacity to absorb certainly carbon dioxide. That's very concerning. I'm not as knowledgeable about what may happen on land, but I think the things that I'm seeing in my world is changes that are underneath the ocean that are visible to those of us who study the ocean, but are invisible to a lot of folks who aren't divers or aren't directly connected to underwater life. And
what are some of those?
Steve can probably speak to what he's seeing on coral reefs and stuff, but you know, what's close to my research area has been what's been happening on the Northern California coast with a real decline in our kelp forests, which seems to be associated with some of the marine heat waves and things that are happening that are probably being accelerated or accentuated by climate change.
Stephen Palumbi?
I agree with both Scott and Karina about those things. And the way I think about it is the ocean is warming and the land is warming because of climate change. And we're seeing increased storms on land and increased storms in the ocean. But there's two other things associated with climate change that are pretty unique to the ocean. One is that there's more of it. The sea level is going up. And the combination of sea level going up and increased storms gives us things like king tides and coastal flooding. Cities that are just now used to having seawater in their streets during high tides because of the combination of increased sea level and storms and waves. And then what Scott mentioned was acidification of the ocean. That is where CO2 going into the ocean turns into carbonic acid, and that makes it more acidic than it usually is. And then that then cascades down to the ability of a lot of different kinds of marine organisms to grow and make their shells. So those categories of change in the ocean because of the climate are global. They are accelerating. They've caused virtually all, I think, marine biologists to worry about the future of different ecosystems. And like Karina said, we're seeing those things play out right now.
So all of you have mentioned ocean acidification, and I don't think the general populations know very much about it. You know, I know the ocean has a particular pH balance, which is changing as a result of the climate change. So I wonder if, Scott Doney, maybe you could walk us through exactly what ocean acidification is, its dynamics, how it interacts, and how it's manifested.
So carbon dioxide is a gas. The way it gets into the ocean is it dissolves in the water. So it's much like if you have a bottle of club soda, they've actually bubbled carbon dioxide through. The carbon dioxide gets dissolved. But as Steve mentioned, unlike other gases like oxygen and nitrogen, the carbon dioxide actually reacts with the water and makes a carbonic acid. And that acid, the addition of acid, changes not just the pH, but particularly important, it changes the amount If you think of a piece of limestone or a, you know, think of the chalk cliffs of Dover, that's actually made out of calcium ions and carbonate ions. And many of the plants and animals and microbes in the ocean build shells out of the same material. So corals, but lots of shellfish like mollusks, clams, oysters, some types of crustaceans, many types of plankton. And when the water gets more acidic, we've shown in the lab and also some in the field that it makes it harder for these organisms to build their shells. They have to use more energy, and that's energy that can't go to growth or reproduction or defense against parasites and diseases. And so we think that in addition to the climate warming, many parts of the ocean life are being threatened by ocean acidification.
And to what extent is that threat happening? And does it also set off some kind of a domino effect? Stephen Palumbi, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. The effects of ocean acidification come in two kind of flavors. One is the global effect, which is slowly accumulating over time as the CO2 in the atmosphere goes up. But there's also these things that have, you could call acidification storms. They occur in coastal areas, and they happen a combination of the global CO2 in the atmosphere plus things like plankton blooms that decay and release a lot of CO2 into the local environment. And those storms, those acidification storms, have already impacted things like, say, oyster farms along the west coast of the United States, where the tiny little baby oysters called bellagers are very susceptible. They're very sensitive to pH, just like Scott was saying. And those farms, for example, have had whole years where the acidification storms that were right around them have prevented them from being able to go ahead and grow those oysters. So that's a little example of the kind of unexpected consequences of this big chemical change that's happening in the ocean.
So, Karina, let's bring you back in here. You look at coastlines and ecosystems along the coastlines. What are you seeing as a result of acidification and also sea level rises?
Well, we're seeing both. A lot of folks here, actually, there's kind of a link between the two on the estuary here. We've been trying to restore some of our native oyster species, and we're concerned about ocean acidification impacting our ability to do that. But the ironic thing in some ways is that we've been looking at nature-based ways of limiting the impacts of sea level rise, and one of those ways has been to promote oyster reefs and the development of those structures to help reduce erosion and help soften, if you will, some of the potential impacts of sea level rise. So, you know, we're not really sure if those two things are going to interact in negative ways, but you could imagine that as we're trying to recover these species, that may have benefits for us in other ways than just, you know, existing or being food for other critters. We may actually be compromising our abilities to protect some of the shoreline. That's kind of these sort of unexpected surprises that Steve was talking about. This is not an area that's emerging as our understanding of how the pH of the ocean changes the way organisms can smell the water, if you will, the chemistry of the water, and may impact their behaviors. And I think that's an area where we may see a lot more surprises in soon. That is a little bit concerning.
So some of the other things I read in the literature that you all have cited that I didn't quite understand and wanted to see if you could help kind of explain the significance of this and what the dynamics of it are. Things like stratification, altering ocean currents. What exactly happens? Scott, Donnie, is that something you can explain?
So the ocean is heating up, and it's heating up starting at the surface is where you're getting the most warming. And so in a typical ocean situation, the water is stratified, light water near the surface, and you have denser and denser water as you go down. As you warm up the water right at the surface, you're actually increasing that stratification. The water gets less and less dense, and that makes it harder for the ocean to mix. And that has a lot of effects on ecosystems because that mixing is what brings up nutrients from below. Nutrients get stripped out of the surface of the ocean by plankton, and if there's not a mechanism to recover those nutrients, it may slow down biological productivity, particularly in the tropical regions around the planet.
And what about dead zones that I've been reading about? What exactly is causing that? Is it a similar dynamic?
The ocean holds oxygen, and the animals need that oxygen that eventually comes from the surface of the ocean. When the water moves away from the surface, oxygen slowly gets consumed because you have a lot of organic matter, basically dead cells, detritus, things sinking down from above. So as you get deeper and deeper into the ocean, there are regions where the oxygen declines naturally because of this biological pump of organic matter down to depth. In a more stratified ocean, what we're seeing is in large parts of the global ocean, oxygen's declining because there's not the circulation is slowing, and the pathway of bringing that fresh oxygen into the ocean interior is being reduced. And potentially that could reach a spot where large parts of the ocean aren't hospitable to marine life. And you know, I'll turn it over to Steve and Karina. This gets exacerbated in coastal regions.
One of the ways it can get exacerbated is the coastal regions are really productive. And sometimes those low oxygen waters may actually get brought up to the surface. They can sometimes have a lot of nitrogen or nutrients in them. It can promote sort of a bloom. But then that same process that I was just describing, those organisms staying again, falling down through the water column in the coastal zone, and they can bring the oxygen level down even. We sometimes see that happen at the mouths of estuaries, so where you have a lot of, on the coast of California, this particular mechanism I was describing might happen off the coast of Oregon. It happened there for some periods of time when we have die-offs and various things like that. So it can cause disruptions to where these organisms live. They may move away from these low oxygen areas. They're like little suffocating areas of the water. They may die in place if they're not very mobile. That's one concern. There are other effects in which this kind of thing can happen. Maybe Steve wants to elaborate.
A lot of the dead zones, for example, aren't that much related to climate change. They tend to form, like you say, at the mouths of estuaries or the mouths of very big rivers like the Mississippi. So one of the famously first dead zones was described right in the Gulf of Mexico near the mouth of the Mississippi River. Huge amounts of fertilizer go down the river. It causes plankton blooms, which die, and the bacteria eat them and produce lots of CO2 and eat up all the oxygen. That's exacerbated by things being warmer because the process is happening faster, for sure. But dead zones are another way that a human impact on the oceans, particularly strong around coastlines and particularly strong in these very productive waters.
So let's keep going down this path of trying to understand all of these various dynamics that are affecting the oceans. But I think there's a really big question that is looming, which is, what does this mean for us?
Yeah, one of the big differences, we started out talking about the difference between the land and the ocean, but we're still using ecosystems in the ocean to a very large extent. We don't get much wild food off of land anymore. There's certainly places in Africa and South America where that do, but we get a lot of wild food out of the ocean. We get a lot of direct benefit from ocean ecosystems, whereas on land, we've tended to push those natural ecosystems away from where we live. And as a consequence, say for coral reefs that I spend a lot of time studying, those reefs support the livelihoods of literally hundreds of millions of people. There are people that get most of their animal protein from fishing around coral reefs. The reefs themselves grow and are enormously great storm walls. A good, healthy reef can absorb up to 97% of the wave energy that hits it. So these living, growing reefs protect communities and towns and structures all along the tropics. So we use those communities, those natural communities, coral reefs, for example, an enormous amount, and they benefit hundreds of millions, billions of people.
I just wanted to follow up on the food supply and fisheries. One of the really interesting things we're seeing is as the ocean warms, fish species have a thermal range, a thermal tolerance. They don't like it too warm or too cold, and each species has a different range. And what we're seeing is that the species are moving polar. For example, where I live in Virginia, the species that used to be found off Virginia are now found up off of New England. And we're seeing a shift to species that used to be living off of Georgia and Florida. And that's not only changing the kind of fish there, but it's making it really challenging for communities that depend upon, you know, fishing for their economy. And so fishers are having to travel further or switch the gear they're using, and that's having a huge impact. The other thing that we're seeing with climate is the expanding of marine diseases. So parasites, bacteria are moving poleward as well with the warmer waters. And we're seeing expanded outbreaks of disease up and down coastlines.
The other affects people is it's not just the commercial fisheries, it's also recreation and tourism. For example, the rise is rising faster often in some cases than beaches can replenish themselves, or that it's butting up against coastal development where there's infrastructure, houses, et cetera, up against the edge of that ecosystem. And as you start losing the beach, you start losing the blanket space, so to speak, right? Where that can have a cascading effect through an entire coastal economy because it can be a really important part of the economy. Happens also when people are used to recreating and diving or abalone diving or spearfishing. You know, if the things that they're used to playing aren't there anymore, they may not come back to those communities.
You know, there was an article in The Guardian perhaps 2 or 3 weeks ago by George Monbiot who said, I think the headline said something particularly dramatic, which was, in order to save the oceans, we must stop eating fish. And it was pretty dramatic. But I mean, what do you make of something like that?
I'm not sure that stopping eating fish is going to stop climate change. And so without stopping climate change, we're not saving the oceans. So I think that, you know, the general structure of what it is we were started talking about, the climate change and the future of the planet sort of comes in there. I really do believe we can certainly continue to eat fish and also save the ocean. How we do that, how we eat fish and which fish we eat has to change. And we've made pretty good strides in that. There's still a lot of ground to cover. Certainly the ability of people to know what kind populations are fished sustainably and to choose to buy those or choose to have those in restaurants has had a big impact on the way fishing is done, at least in some places. Unfortunately, there's an enormous number of people around the world who are desperate for even a small income from fishing, and they don't have the luxury of deciding not to eat a fish because it might be overfished. And those are the real problems, because those people need that food, they need that protein, they need that income, and the impoverishment of coastal ecosystems actually is one of the huge problems that we face in knowing how to use the ocean sustainably.
So what are some of the mitigation measures that we really need to be taking? Obviously, reducing, you know, our emissions is a big one, which is hard to do when we've got certain leadership in place that are wanting to destroy rainforest and increase the carbon industries. What do we do given all of this? What are some measures we can make ourselves or with local governments? Karina, what do you think? You've looked at some of these policies.
You know, and I've been thinking deeply about this for a long time. I think a lot of people feel disempowered because the levers of power to affect the things you've just described are maybe out of some of our reach. But I really believe firmly that every action that we take at the local level, every conversation you have with someone who may not be clear on the importance of climate, both to its connect their day-to-day lives, makes an increment. You can think about death by 1,000 cuts two ways, right? You can think about it having an impact on you in a negative way, or you can think about the collective action of all of us pushing forward with both education and advocacy through democratic processes for the changes we want to see. So I don't think people should walk away feeling disempowered. Conversations like this are really important. I think pushing our elected officials in the places where we have agency is really important.
And are there specific measures, like if you are advocating to your political leaders, that you would advocate for, given what you know as a scientist?
I have a few. You know, in addition to the, you know, the carbon mitigation you mentioned, you know, one of the biggest impacts in coastal regions is coastal development and destruction of these valuable, you know, wetlands, marshes, mangrove forests. So that's one area where we have learned that we can't take those for granted. We need to actually protect those. The other particularly important for coastal is, Steve and Karina were mentioning, these excess nutrients that are coming into the coastline. Those are things that our actions on land, whether it's agricultural, septic systems and sewage, fertilizer. We have a pretty good idea how to reduce those nutrients, but it takes a community willpower to be able to do that.
And I think, you know, as you were saying, the wetlands and the underwater vegetation, that's something that we think about a lot. And right in my backyard, I'm looking out on San Francisco Bay here right now, and they hold an enormous amount of carbon just by existing. And so preserving what we have and trying to encourage restoration of wetlands and underwater eelgrass beds and meadows and things like that can actually be things that can be done on a local level that are very helpful.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about how is climate change affecting the ocean and marine life? How is the melting of sea ice affecting sea animals? How are some changing to adapt to climate change? We speak with three experts. Karina Nielsen, she is a professor of biology and the executive director of the Estuary and Ocean Science Center at San Francisco State University. Stephen Palumbi is a professor in marine sciences at Stanford University and the director of the Hopkins Marine Station. Scott Donney is a professor in environmental change in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia. So I want to turn just for a second, Steve Palumbi, into some of the animals and the effects on animals, both because I've read about some of the more detrimental effects, including some marine mammals going a little bit crazy. I don't know what that's necessarily from, but also because you've noted that there have been changes to resiliency and that might be preventing some extinctions. So I thought perhaps you could talk to us about what's happening with some of the animals, including the mammals.
Sure. Riff off of one of the things Karina just said about restoring and building resilience in coastal ecosystems in order to be able to take advantage of them. And one of the ways I think that biologists and conservation biologists especially can really help is by looking around and saying, how can I help preserve what's here so that when we solve the climate crisis, and we will have to, and the planet starts getting better and the CO2 levels start to drop, there is enough left to grow back from. And so that's what I sort of try to dedicate what I do to, is like saving as much as we can now. So there is this to grow back from. You know, the best climate story that I know about marine mammals is actually the lost gray whales. Gray whales migrate up through the Pacific and they go up to Alaska. They feed on bottom critters, these little amphipods on the bottom, in very cold water. And as that water is warmed, then they have started going further and further north through the Bering Straits into the northern slopes of Alaska and along Canada. And one of them actually appeared off the coast of Israel a few years ago. And all of us saw this picture and said, no, there's no way that a gray whale is off the coast of Israel, but there it was. And the answer for that seemed to be that the whale had migrated way far north because of climate change, was way up above Canada. It started getting to be winter, and so they do what they do. It's headed south through the nearest ocean, which was the Atlantic instead of the Pacific. And then it turned left in the mouth of a really big estuary, which it thought was, you know, one of the bays in Baja where they go to breed, but it was the Mediterranean instead, and then it ended up off the coast of Israel. Poor thing. I mean, it was just totally globally lost because of climate change. No one ever saw it again. That's the kind of shift that Scott was talking about at the very beginning, where fish stocks and lobsters and all kinds of creatures are moving as a response to ocean warming. You can look at it two ways. You can look at it at the way, well, oh my gosh, that's really a strong change and it's causing everybody to do something different. But you can also say, this is the resilience of those populations that can actually move and keep their habitat, keep their environment what they're used to because they can move into a new one. I tend to work on things that live and attach to the bottom, like corals, And they can't move. They can't move as adults. So once they land and start to grow someplace, they're like a tree. They're there for 100 years or 200 years. And so there we've been looking at how different corals in different places can adapt and change themselves through a sort of environmental process of acclimation or an evolutionary process of adaptation to become better at living in warmer water. And that process of adaptation in the future is something that I'm very interested in knowing. How much will it help us save what we need to?
Are some species really more resilient than others? Are you finding that some are really changing? I know that you've looked at DNA structures as part of this.
Sure. Speak a little bit more about corals. There's some kinds of corals that are much more resilient to heat and even acidification than others. The really big corals that form mounds in the Caribbean and the Pacific are pretty well known to be the most resilient to heat and acidification. But they also grow really slowly. And they are then not the kinds of things that can rebound very quickly from, say, a hurricane or other damage. The fast-growing corals, I usually study those because they can rebound so quickly and they're a great thing to study for a whole ecosystem to come back to life. Those fast-growing corals are pretty susceptible to heat. That's what's caused coral bleaching all over the world in the last couple of years especially. And it's a serious problem in these corals basically dying over the course of a week because the water is just too warm for them.
And then that would, of course, have an effect on all of the critters that rely on them. And also, aren't the coral reefs the providers of oxygen?
No, they photosynthesize because they have these symbionts inside them that help them make food. They're not a huge source of oxygen. And actually, at night, they absorb and they use oxygen. So I'm not even sure they're a net producer very much of it.
So the aspect of corals that are considered the lungs, when people refer to them as lungs, what is that referring to?
You know, I don't remember people talking about corals so much as lungs. There's certainly lots of parts of the ocean that are producing a lot of oxygen, and those are the microscopic algae that are floating through most of the upper couple hundred feet of the ocean produce a vast amount of oxygen. Scott will know the exact figures, but something like a third of the oxygen in our atmosphere now, it comes from those tiny little oxygen. Is that about right, Scott?
Actually, just the last several weeks, there's been a lot of confusion about oxygen. And of all the problems facing our planet, we actually have quite a bit of oxygen in the atmosphere. And most of the oxygen that's in the atmosphere is relic because at some point, some fossil organic carbon got buried somewhere in a peatland or in a marine sediment. Even if something catastrophic were to happen on land or the ocean, you know, loss of parts of the Amazon forests or coral reefs or marine plankton, it's not going to have a big dent on atmospheric oxygen. There are sort of bigger problems to worry about, and I think it goes back to all these services, you know, whether it's recreation or tourism or fishing, commercial, recreational, survival fishing. Those are the things that I spend more time worrying about.
You know, the real thing about what corals do with producing oxygen and photosynthesizing is they invented this incredible trick. About a quarter of a billion years ago, they grow in pretty non-productive waters. That's why tropical water is so wonderful. It's warm and it's clear. It's wonderful to be in. It's clear because it's not very productive. But coral reefs are very productive ecosystems, and it's because corals have formed the home for these algae that live inside them. And the coral feed the algae the nutrients they need to be productive, and then the algae have a place to live in the very, very bright sunlight and photosynthesize. So this symbiosis between the coral and its alga is the reason why coral reefs can be so productive, and the reason why human communities in the tropical and tropic coastlines have been able to do so well, because they're living in a very productive marine environment.
As ecologists, we often talk about species that people may be curious about why we think they're so important. And even though a kelp forest or an eelgrass meadow or a coral reef in and of itself may go like, so what? What if it disappeared? Well, all the fishes that live in there, all the little crustaceans that live in there, all the food, it's the home, it's the shelter, it's the hiding place from predators, it's the predator feeding grounds. It creates a foundation for all of marine life. that's what's so important about them.
Yeah, that's really important for us to understand, I think. I think the last thing I'd really like to understand is about the loss of sea ice, because we keep seeing in the media headlines about a glacier melting and X percent going. Is there a quantification of what is actually happening? And Scott, perhaps this is yours, something that you've looked at. How should we understand this loss of glacier, loss of sea ice?
So the first thing is sort of distinguish between when we talk about sea ice, we're usually talking about ice that's floating on the surface of the ocean. It may be, you know, between a few feet to maybe a 10 feet thick versus glaciers and ice sheets, which are based on land, can be the ice sheets in Greenland are 2 kilometers thick. It's important in two ways. One is that when ice on land melts, Steve had mentioned this earlier, that extra water from that melt is actually acting to raise sea level. But if sea ice melts, it's already floating. That Archimedes principle, it doesn't have effect on sea level. Biologically, many types of polar life, polar organisms, have adapted to the presence of sea ice. And particularly in the Arctic, and I work down along the Antarctic Peninsula, south of Chile and Argentina, we're seeing large disappearance of the sea ice. And that makes it very hard for the organisms, these polar organisms. They don't have any place else to migrate to, unlike, say, temperate species that can move north where it's a little bit cooler. If your life history depends upon that sea ice for breeding or for feeding, when that disappears, it makes it almost catastrophic for those species.
What are some of those species that you're talking about?
So I work in the Antarctic. One of the penguin species that's one of the sort of key species in the environment we work on are called adelies. And the adelies use the ice during the winter. That's what they use the ice edge to feed off of. And then during the summer, when the ice melts, it actually stratifies the water and traps phytoplankton right near the surface where there's a lot of light. And you get these giant phytoplankton blooms that are then fed on by krill. And then the krill are fed on by the penguins. And so they have their breeding colonies are in spots where you have big phytoplankton blooms. When that ice goes away, we don't see the blooms nearly as large. And we think that's leading to what we see, which is a very large collapse in some of these populations along the Antarctic Peninsula. Similar things are seen in the Arctic with walrus, polar bears, lots of different species that depend upon the sea ice.
So, Stephen Palumbi, how are organisms adapting to these changes?
What we see in coral reefs, but also along the west coast of the United States, is that these marine species live in very heterogeneous environments. And that means some of them live in warmer waters and some in cooler waters. And as a result, over time, they've evolved strategies of dealing with some variation in the temperature. For example, we work in a lovely small country named Palau that's about 600 to 800 miles south of the Philippines in the western Pacific. And you can be snorkeling across a fabulously wonderful coral reef, you know, 100% cover of corals of all kinds of colors and shapes and myriads of fishes all over. And you realize, wow, this water is really warm, and it might be 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 34, 35 degrees centigrade. And those corals are supposed to be dead at those temperatures because they can't survive those warm temperatures. But those corals can do it. And those places and those kinds of reefs have really sparked us to wonder, right, where do you find corals that are heat resistant? And we've developed a way of mapping them. And we find them in lots of different places and lots of different settings. And it gives us hope that, in fact, as the oceans warm, at least some populations of these corals will last a little bit longer. I still think, personally, that they're going to need help. And their current level of say, heat resistance is nowhere near going to be enough for the year 2100. But it gives us a handle, gives us something to work on, something to strive for, and some way of saying, well, this is what we're going to do for the next 20 or 30 years as biologists, as we encourage you know, the financial part of our society and the political and religious, just to help us solve climate change, we have this other job to do too, which is to save what's there.
Do you think that some of these resilient species will also be some of the larger fauna?
You know, I don't know. You know, you can think of the larger ones as, you know, the mammals, the sea lions, for example, the whales, which as Scott pointed out, can move, and mostly the large fish, like the tunas and the billfish, you know, in some cases they're not that resilient, but they can move. And so those are big advantages to species like that. Now, our job is to make sure they're allowed to move. That when they start migrating into new places, we reformulate the fisheries regulations that we've got, so it protects them in new zones as well as their old zones. And those are ways of thinking forward and helping these species help themselves.
You know, I think Steve has been talking about sort of the fundamental sort of source of hope, Bill, is that there are things to do now to protect things into the future. I think there are lots of surprises in store for us, and I hope they're not all bad ones. but I think I was kind of talking about that, right? These local conservation actions, the little refuges, if you will, that we're going to create to hold and nurture the species that are doing well under sort of more changed circumstances and allow them to move and thrive and do well in new places is going to be really important work.
And about those penguins, Scott, Donnie, what about those penguins?
Well, what's interesting is that we're seeing an invasion of a different penguin species. So I work at one of the U.S. bases along the peninsula, and the penguin species that's declining has a very rigid life history, and it's being replaced by a penguin species that is more flexible, more of a generalist. And so there will be winners and losers. This is what we're going to see, is a shift in what populates the ocean. There are lots of organisms that may actually thrive under a different climate, a different ocean. But it's, you know, how are we going to, as society, adapt to those changes in what's there?
God, you used to have a message for us about, I'll leave it at that.
Yes.
You used to live in Cape Cod, Scott, and one of the changes that's going on there is that white sharks are starting to show up along that coast because the prey populations are back and the water is warming along there. That's, I think, another case where we're having to learn to live with a totally different kind of critter that's moved in because the world is changing around us.
Stephen Palumbi, you can't mention sharks without talking about your shark fin DNA then.
Okay. that actually is, you know, not a very happy, peppy story, though, so I'm not sure we want to end on that one either. But what we were able to do is to look at the DNA content of a shark fin, and then from that DNA, tell what shark it was. Now, maybe it seems like we should be able to tell what shark it was anyway, but a lot of sharks are really hard to tell apart from their fins, and more and more and more, the shark fin business in the world, which kills about 70 million sharks every single year for their fins for shark fin soup. That business is scouring every ocean for almost every kind of shark. I've seen fins in shark in fin markets that look like they must have come from baby sharks, a foot long or so. And when you get the DNA out of them, you realize that, okay, they are species all over the world, and a lot of them are threatened and endangered species, species that are on what's called the IUCN Red List of marine species that are severely overexploited. So we're sort of using that as a way of helping monitor how we use the ocean. We import 4 to 5 billion pounds of seafood in the United States, for example, every single year. What are we importing? Where is it coming from? Is that where we want to be eating from in terms of the ocean buffet table? And the DNA work helps us try to figure that out.
Well, final thoughts. Let's just get your closing ideas and where we're going from here. Scott, Donnie?
I guess I'm optimistic that, you know, the oceans are more and more
being included in policy discussions from the local level up to the international level. And I think as a scientist, my goal moving forward is to help work on solutions. Solutions that work both for the natural environment, but also for human communities. And how can human communities find a balance of how they interact with the ocean and we all benefit?
Karina Nielsen?
That is pretty much aligned with what I do here as well, and my hopes for the future. I work a lot with students who are very passionate about the ocean and the natural environment, and teaching them solutions is I find very important on every day.
And final thoughts, Stephen Palumbi.
I totally agree, and that one of the problems with the oceans is so big that any problem that's significant in the ocean is by its very nature a really big problem. And people are just naturally inclined to say, well, that's too big. We can't handle that. It's just too much. But in fact, we can begin to handle that. And a lot of the efforts that people are putting in are local efforts, but that they build up to help along the whole coastline. For example, marine protected areas are very local. A local community agrees to protect some part of the shoreline from some kind of fishing or extraction or pollution or something. And they see almost an immediate local benefit from that. So convincing people that the ocean is big and wonderful and awesome and that they can do something locally that will really help is part of this solution. Totally agree about the future of students and how we get them engaged and excited about it. And that's one of the things I think these kind of conversations can really say. There's hope out there. We have a lot of work to do. Let's try to take what hope there is and then sort of fan the flames so that we get the most out of it.
I thank the three of you very much for joining us and sharing your research and your knowledge and your thoughts with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Karina Nielsen, she is a professor of biology and the executive director of the Estuary and Ocean Science Center at San Francisco State University. She's the co-author of California's fourth climate assessment, Coast and Ocean Summary Report, and Emerging Understanding of Seagrass and Kelp as an Ocean Acidification Management Tool in California. Stephen Palumbi is a professor in marine sciences at Stanford University and the director of the Hopkins Marine Station. He is the co-author of publications including Using Naturally Occurring Climate Resilient Corals to Construct Bleaching Resistant Nurseries and Impacts of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services. Scott Donney is professor in environmental change in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia. He's the co-author of numerous publications, including Strengthened Scientific Support for Endangerment Finding for Atmospheric Greenhouse Gases and Anthropogenic Ocean Acidification Over the 21st Century and Its Impact on Calcifying Organisms. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.